you know, computer vision is big.
For like cancer detection.
Yeah, all of those things are already being readily used. There are robots that do precision surgeries that are almost as good, if not better, than humans at this point. I mean, those things do happen and they are creating more and more trust. But as far as kind of R&D, like research that's being done by AI for then, before it goes into clinical, for humans to fully trust all of that in order to say, okay, you know what, we're ready to go into clinical, that still humans are very much involved with that. And I think that's still going to be the case in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the EVN Disrupt podcast. My name is Nishat Sathurian, and I'm the editor of the tech section here at EVN Report. Our guest today is Zarga Zugabian, the head of the Americas division of eLab Next. eLab Next is a biotech company that builds digital notebook tools for scientists. We spoke about how they have integrated generative AI into their product workflows, as well as some of the barriers that exist in wider AI adoption in the biotech space. Zarga also shared with us what he's excited about in the field, and lastly, how he's become an investor over the last year. Thank you for listening. Zarga, thank you so much for being back on.
Glad to be here.
I think you're the fifth person to come back on for a second time. And sweet. We've done, I think, about close to 90 episodes now. So.
Okay.
So you were here exactly 2 years ago. Let's start with just catching up. What have you been up to for the last 2 years, and what has eLab Next been up to?
Yeah, a lot has changed. The industry as a whole has changed a lot, right? So about 2 years ago, it was at the end of the pandemic, towards the end, and there was still a lot of industry money that was flowing around, and a lot of these startups that got funding, that got a lot of this VC money in order for them to grow their business, thought that anything is possible at that time. And during that time, a lot of businesses with not real science also got a lot of funding as well. So there was a bit of a bubble. And right now, the landscape is very different. One, because of that, because of the pandemic boom that we had, and a lot of companies started to think that, okay, this is it, this is the new trajectory. But in reality, that wasn't, right? So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it, it was the rise of AI. So when AI came in, it seems like from out of nowhere, even though it has been developing for a very long time, that really changed the dynamics of the industry. Luckily, we as a company have been able to adapt, and we kind of knew that this is coming. And we started, you know, integrating with a lot of AI tools. We started to grow our API and our SDK. The documentation of all of that has been developed in order for us to be prepared for all of these new AI companies that are coming in, for them to be able to integrate into our system and utilize our network that we already have established over the past 15 years in the industry. So from that perspective, you know, there's this big industry change that's happening. So that's what has been new in the last 2 years. We personally, our team has been growing in a very healthy way in the Americas, also in Europe, in Australia. And then on the side of eLab Next, I've also launched a consulting / investing firm with the founder of eLab Next, with one of the founders, Dr. Erwin Sinan. I hope he can come to Armenia and actually be part of this podcast. Fantastic. As well. Yeah. And that has been fun building, because, you know, we essentially have figured out what it takes to be successful. Mm-hmm. We know what, you know, how to enter the US market, how to get, you know, your footing in the industry, get your first 10, 20, 30, 500 customers. Build the credibility and just be part of the biotech ecosystem. Mm-hmm. We know the template. We know what it takes to get there. So we kind of put our heads together and we said, okay, why don't we, you know, all these companies are coming to us and asking for advice and for help. Why don't we create a company that can assist them with that in a more structured way? So we did that as well. So I would say those are kind of the two big highlights from a professional kind of perspective. Yeah.
Let's start with the VC landscape that you touched on. We're nowhere near close to immediate pre-pandemic and pandemic levels of startup funding, but it seems like there's some traction building up, and some SaaS companies and a lot of AI companies are raising decent sized rounds again in the Series A level, the seed level. I don't know if we've seen a ton at the later stages, like Series C, D, or we haven't really seen many IPOs or anything yet. But in the more deep tech, biotech space, where capital is, these companies are much more capital intensive than some SaaS company or some basic software company. are we seeing a pickup in investments, even just compared to, let's say, late 2022 or middle of 2022 when things had really dried up?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And, you know, I mean, these are the kind of conversations that we're having, you know, in Boston, and every single lunch, dinner meeting, all, you know, all these industry friends that we have, every conversation is like, hey, are you noticing anything that's changing? Is there any pickup and so on? And, you know, everybody was saying elections. That's going to be the deciding factor. Let's wait till November. Let's see what happens. It's just when people don't know what's going to happen, they're a bit afraid to spend money.
So the stability that...
It doesn't matter which one becomes the president. It's just knowing what's going to happen allows people to spend a bit more freely. When there is inconsistency, when there is kind of this political turmoil where you don't know what's going to happen, people are just a bit more hesitant to spend money.
Predictability matters.
Yeah, absolutely. And there wasn't really serious money being spent up until end of June, July, August. And there was this big funding announcement from our friends at Flagship, right, with $3.6 billion. And that, you know, a lot of people are looking at that as the starting point for what's going to happen coming up. But those stories are very few, right? Mm-hmm. There were a few other companies out there. They got, you know, good funding. What's happening right now is a lot of mergers and acquisitions. What's happening is a lot of just, you know, hostile takeovers. A lot of these small companies that were able to get funding, they were able to kind of make things work, you know, get funding every couple of years or whatever. If they were not able to, let's say, bring in the right people, if they were not able to get that science right to a point for it to kind of IPO, those companies are no longer being able to keep up. And now they're forced to get rid of their intellectual property. All of their patents, all of their scientists are now looking for the next thing. So there's very clearly, there's some kind of a calibration that's happening in the industry.
So they're kind of being sold for cheap to bigger companies.
Right. Then there's another trend that's happening in big pharma. You know, there was a big boom about, you know, 20, 30 years ago where a lot of companies, you know, big pharma companies were able to, you know, get a lot of drugs into the market. They had patents and so on. So now the patent cliff is very realistic. So now a lot of these big pharma companies are closing down departments, are selling off a lot of things. And now they're looking for the next up-and-comers, you know, small, mid-sized biotech companies for them to be able to buy off and have them become, you know, their new product within their company. So that's another kind of trend that we're noticing.
What about in the earlier stages, like companies that are just getting off the ground? Is seed funding something that's picking up in the biotech space, or is Series A?
I don't see it, no. Yeah. And we work with a lot of these incubators. You know, you have Lab Central, you have The Engine, you have MBI, you have ABI Labs, you have Smart Labs, you have Bio Labs. Before the pandemic and during the pandemic, the first, you know, year or two, there were 10 different residents waiting in the wait list for them to be part of this incubator spaces. Now there's so many incubators out there that looked at that as like a business gimmick and created new incubators and so on. But on top of that, also just simply there isn't enough money flowing around and there isn't enough interesting new ideas, that a lot of these incubators are at 80% capacity. They're at 70%. Some in New York are at 15%, 20%.
Wow.
Because, you know, on top of all of this, then we also have to take into consideration not just kind of mathematical and statistical things into perspective, but also human behavior. So during the pandemic, a lot of people started to work from home and they enjoyed that. They loved that. They started moving out of the cities, going into, you know, New Hampshire and Maine and buying up more land and working from there. But now when things are coming back, these people they don't feel like moving back into the city. So New York is really suffering from that because a lot of people moved out of New York. But at that same time, a lot of new incubator spaces opened up and now they're not being able to fill it in because nobody wants to be, you know, on the train or in the car and commute for 4 hours a day. So there is something that's happening that we're noticing. And I think, you know, I personally think in the next 2 years, I don't think it's going to be right after the elections. I think in the next 2 years, there's going to be a new reality, a new tendency that, that we're going to see in this space.
As in, you think in 2 years, things will pick up or?
Yes, things will pick up. But, you know, one thing that's very clear that right now it's quality over quantity, whereas during the pandemic it was just like just everybody was investing in everything. And now it's much more selective. But you know, and there's different kind of arguments to be made on that, right? So in order for there to be innovation, in order for there to kind of, you have to take risks. It's, I know, high risk, high reward. So a wide net of investment might not be a bad strategy, right? I mean, that's maybe what makes US different from many other countries, is just like, hey, whatever, let's just throw money at it. Let's see what works. But now, you know, the pendulum is swinging the other way because so many companies failed that now, you know, they're just are being much more selective. The process of looking at the numbers, looking at the science is becoming very long. During that time, the money is drying up at some of these companies. You know, the due diligence is taking a lot of time these days. So it's quite interesting watching all of that from the sideline. And the reason why I say sideline is because we work, those are our clients, right? From the big pharma all the way to the small startups. So we know the kind of pain points that they're going through. And, you know, digitizing their research is that much more important right now, because they might need to sell off their IP. They might need to showcase their funders that they are on top of their shit, you know, to put it mildly. And that they are ready for AI, they're ready for building, you know, LLMs from the data that they're collecting. To me, it's clear that right now it's not stable, and in the next 2 years there it will stabilize, but to which direction it will go, it's not very clear yet.
It's interesting. So like from that perspective, eLab Next almost allows them to create their war rooms for presenting to investors or potential acquisition partners.
Right. Absolutely. And you know, about, let's say, 7 years ago, I would have to teach, you know, scientists what lab digitization is in the first place. Now I'm talking about data integrity. I'm talking about metadata fields and API endpoints, and how important it is for you to standardize everything, because soon there will be so many AI tools that are just in our day-to-day life that needs to interact with all of that data that you created in order for you to go to the next stage of innovation within your company. And if you don't have structured data, you are done, you are screwed. And all of these other companies are going to really be much more advanced, much faster. And there's going to be this huge gap almost immediately between the companies that digitize and then the ones that don't.
Before we dive deeper into some of the AI trends that you briefly touched on earlier, and you said you've been integrating more and more into eLab Next, just for people who haven't listened to the episode we did 2 years ago, tell us what your product is. What does eLab Next do exactly?
Sure, yeah. So eLab Next is a digital lab platform which houses digital tools like ELN, Electronic Lab Notebook, or LIMS, Laboratory Information Management System, or Inventory Management System, which essentially helps labs to optimize their research and process development workflow in a compliant and secure environment. So in other words, labs that are doing their research, they need to keep track of their data, whether it's, you know, their sample data, their protocols, their day-to-day reports, and then they need to be able to mine that data and be able to get insights from it in order to pivot their research in the right direction. They need to stay HIPAA compliant, they need to stay CLIA compliant, you know, FDA compliant, and all of that. You know, traditionally people did that in notebooks, you know, pen and paper. Then they started doing that with, you know, Excel and Word documents and Google Docs and so on. And now it's tools like ours that are helping them to do that. And that connection from the researchers in there, you know, the folks that are in the trenches that are doing day-to-day work, to the data scientists, to then being submitted for FDA and so on. Mm-hmm. We basically have created a very clear path for people to be able to do that through the tools that we provide.
So I'm a biologist. Mm-hmm. Say I work in a wet lab, and I'm doing experiments and I'm collecting that data. The eLab platform gives me sort of the best way to collect and store that data and take my notes and like compile my research and stuff.
To also automate, to also manage workflows.
Automate so, what exactly? Like analysis of data, things like that?
Analysis of data or the integration of instruments, right? So if you want to click on a button, which then let's say runs some kind of a script on a robot.
Okay.
That's like a liquid handling robot like Hamilton. Let's say you're using Nikon microscopes and you want to be able to, after taking the picture of a particular cell, then that pushes it into eLab,
mm-hmm.
analyzes it, gives you the, you know, those kinds of things, right. Those kinds of automations. So it's not just the data dump software where you simply right. just keep track of things, but then there's also workflow management and integration into other systems. So we like to call ourselves kind of the glue that connects everything together. So for example, a hospital needs to connect to their health, e-health kind of software, which they're not going to host any of the, let's say, specific patient information within eLab, but they will host it in another system, but all of the lab work they will host in eLab, but they need that connection between the two systems, or a government agency, or, you know. So, and our target audience is any lab that does research, but we kind of look at it as biotech startups, labs with 0 to 500 people. We look at big pharma, which is, 500 and plus. And then there's academia, there's hospitals, and government labs as well, like CDC, for example.
So one thing, as you were explaining that, that just popped in my head, which is really exciting, is the data that is being inputted into your systems mm-hmm. is becoming structured. And you have not only this place where this data is managed, but you have systems that the data can be processed through and get some new results or some new insight from it. And all of this is like API accessible and stuff, I'm assuming. So now we have the age of LLMs, which like the most basic of it would be you input some LLM into this eLab system and you can ask questions about your research and your data right, and things of that right. nature. But you can also do really interesting agentic workflows for taking this set of data that I just got from this experiment and processing it through this some analysis that gives me some new output that I can understand my data better from. So with all of these, with this technology now being readily available and super cheap and increasingly becoming more and more effective, I think agents work way better today than they did even just like 6 to 8 months ago. What are the opportunities that you guys are exploring there? How are you incorporating all this into it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, biotech is still a very conservative industry. Let me take a step back before I answer that. So 5 years ago, labs would collect all of this data. Then they would send it to a CRO to do the analysis. They would get the...
What's a CRO?
A contract research organization. They would get all the data insight, and then they would get the information, and then they would make decisions and so on. So sometimes you might spend 3 to 5 years on a particular project before you even make a decision, and you're just like wasted 3 to 5 years of your life. Now, because of these readily available tools that are out there, and data scientists themselves as people are now being brought into these groups much faster.
Mm-hmm.
And the data analysis is happening real time. You collect data 3 to 6 months, you quickly analyze a few things, you make adjustments, then you move on. And so that life cycle of data analysis is changing a lot. So using that as a foundational element of what it takes right now to do research, one thing that we are exploring is having a built-in LLM in our system. But with that said, our customers are not fully ready to kind of give all of their data to quote-unquote unpredictable AI, right? So what's happening is now companies that can afford to build their own LLM are now just simply integrating that into our system, and it remains within their ecosystem, but it doesn't apply to the rest of our customers.
But those are very few people, I imagine.
Yes, those are few. But it is something that we're noticing where, these companies are like, it's great, this AI revolution, awesome.
But it has to be ours.
Yeah, good job, Elon Musk, you guys are doing great. But we want to have our own.
Do you mean fine tuning something like Llama that is pre-trained, something that is released by one of the big players, or
no,
pre-training something?
No, that's exactly, no, building their own from scratch. So they're not even willing to use Llama. They're not willing to use, you know, ChatGPT or any of these other things. We do have an integration with ChatGPT, but we do have to have, you know, a warning whenever they want to install that, hey, this is on you. If you want to continue using this, this is going to be crawling through your system.
Right.
Up to you if you want to use it or not. And there are people that fully embrace it, and then there are still companies that do not. So we are lucky that we play this kind of middleman in a way, you know, that glue that we can just turn on and off these things and allow our customers to be the deciders if they want to use it or not. You know, for example, one of our big pharma companies, which I won't say the name, they have created their own LLM through, you know, 50 years of data that they have been collecting. They've been using eLab only in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. So now they're integrating, you know, that data repository all together. They're building their own large language model, and they're also creating these shortcuts where if you say, let's say you're in a hood, your hands are busy, you cannot, you know, type anything. You say, hey, eLab, it uses the Hey Siri command, goes through the iPhone, and they can ask, you know, they can ask a question, you know, hey, where is my sample located? Or I'm doing X, Y, and Z. Please go ahead and put this information in my notes. It does all of that, but then it uses generative AI that they have created, which then summarizes everything based on the data that have been collecting all these years. So it creates context to what they're talking about. And then they go back into eLab once their hands are free, and they go ahead and edit it further. My imagination takes me that, you know, it's going to get to a point where that will be almost perfect as to how all of that data is being collected. But right now there is still a lot of involvement. There's still a lot of integrations that they have to do, and there's still a lot of human interaction that they are implementing.
Yeah. I guess that's super understandable given all the constraints that biotech companies work under. But it's also kind of disappointing because no matter how, like, they're very well-funded biotech companies, obviously, that have a lot of AI expertise and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, like, you probably won't see the full potential of what an LLM could do for your workflow unless you're using really the top system that is available to you. And it just seems unlikely that it would be something built in-house by a biotech company, especially if you think of like agentic workflows and trying to automate things by giving the LLMs access to different tools and stuff that they could use and things. It seems like it would be a stretch to, it would be a lot to expect from a biotech company to be able to build the best tool choice AI.
Right. And they're already behind, yeah. Right? So, you know, there's companies out there that are already years much more advanced, and they've have so much data within them that they have looked at. But then the argument against that is, you know, there's, you know, bias that's involved. There's, you know, all this, you know, ethical questions. Not even mathematical, which I think there's also a lot of mathematical questions to be asked. Yeah, it's quite fascinating. I think the way that they're looking at it is specific functions that they are experts in. They want to have their own AI that gets involved with it, and they do not want any other system to be involved with that. For things that are a bit more general, people feel more comfortable to use. So for example, you know, NVIDIA created this device. I believe it was NVIDIA. Correct me if I'm wrong, you know, folks that are listening. That this device, if you put it in your house, it's able to understand, it's able to track your movements and the heat that you give off, the vibrations and the frequency that you give off, and it can predict if you have, you know, early onset on Alzheimer's, or if you're about to get sick with COVID, or, you know, whatever it is. And they have developed this so much that now they've placed this in many, you know, retirement homes, and they've been able to catch so many of these early onset, you know, diseases, and be able to treat these folks.
What's the input on that? Like, what's it? You said heat sensing?
Yeah, there's heat sensing.
So there's a correlation between Alzheimer's and heat sensing?
I guess so.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember reading this at one of the classes I took at MIT. It's called AI in Biopharma, great class. And that was one of the examples. You know, things like that, people are much more readily available to, much more readily
willing to
to adopt, because it's what's going to happen if you go and check and there isn't any disease, right? Mm-hmm. Like you don't lose anything, versus if you have, you know, 100,000 patient data and you all of a sudden develop a drug that now is going to be readily available for people, and then there's all these side effects from it that you did not anticipate.
You don't want to send that to OpenAI servers,
right?
Which is understandable,
right?
Do you think that's a trend that changes? Do you think there's a OpenAI does something or Google does something that makes these companies feel totally comfortable just plugging in their APIs into a complex biotech workflow?
My gut feeling says no. I don't think so, because the public pop culture has already caught that the wave of these things, and now the association with them is it's for writing blogs, it's for doing video, it's doing entertainment, it's writing poetry. You know, that's kind of the feel that a lot of people have. And even as a scientist in a lab who understands coding and knows bioinformatics and so on, that person becomes hesitant to use a system like that. Unless those companies create kind of these side companies that uses the technology of, let's say OpenAI. However, it is, let's say, a closed system, and it specifically only does, biology or chemistry or something like that. And if there are a couple of success stories that come from that, then people would be willing to utilize, right? So, for example, we know that, lawyers are really loving these new AI tools that are available, because it's so difficult with a, human eye to read through 10,000 pages and find discrepancies. Now the system does it for you. In science, there's so many different, variables that come into play, and is directly impacting a life of a person, that we need a couple of very good success stories in order for people to start trusting in it. At the moment, there isn't any, there is no such story that's circulating in the industry, right?
Maybe not in LLMs yet, but in biotech more broadly, I guess AlphaFold by Google would be an example of something.
Yeah, and there's even other ones, right? So, computer vision is right. Big.
Cancer detection.
Those things are already being readily used. There are robots that do precision surgeries that are almost as good, if not better, than humans at this point. I mean, those things do happen, and they are creating more and more trust. But as far as kind of R&D, like research that's being done by AI for then, before it goes into clinical, for humans to fully trust all of that in order to say, okay, you know what, we're ready to go into clinical, that still humans are very much involved with that. And I think that's still going to be the case in the next, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Let's put your investor hat on. Mm-hmm, you said you and one of the co-founders of eLabNext have started consulting and investment firm. What's something you're seeing in the biotech space that gets you really excited about what's to come, and something that'll maybe indirectly, but something that'll be translated into our everyday lives in 10 years or whatever timeline is reasonable for biotech?
Right. Yeah. So we specifically looked at biotech SaaS only. That's our specialty. So, as far as biotech companies as a whole that are doing research, there's a couple of big trends that we're noticing. One of them is of course the gut microbiome space, because then the research that they do in figuring out what's going to be helpful for a particular human, then to create kind of vitamins or drinks or whatever, it's much easier than, let's say, creating drugs that needs to be FDA approved and so on. So a lot of these gut microbiome labs pivot into commercial space as well.
You mean custom, like some custom vitamin?
So that too, cocktail? Of course, like custom for an individual, of course, because now you can go ahead and, send your blood, your stool, your saliva. They're able to very quickly do these kind of tests, see what you're sensitive to, what you're not sensitive to, and so on, and be able to either give you diet advice or create some kind of a cocktail of a powder and send it over to you. But then there's also just readily available for the masses, just general kind of these, you know, green powders and you know, there's, I mean, the trend is AG1 insane. Yeah, like AG1. Yeah. I mean, there's some stuff that's called the mud. I don't know how real that is or if it's a gimmick. I have no idea. I haven't looked into that. But there's clearly a trend. There's a lot of, you know, nootropics. There's a lot of these powders that are from mushrooms. And it's clearly there's a trend of this is happening. But at the core of it, a lot of the research is in gut microbiome space. And there was a trend about 3-4 years ago that we noticed a lot of Chinese scientists were coming from China and opening up labs specifically for that, because over there that's very developed, right? You know, thousands of years of people taking different, mm-hmm. you know, herbs and things like that. So they really understand the science of the gut. And a lot of these new labs in Rutgers University and in Columbia and all these places are focusing on that. So that's one thing that to me is very clear that it's going to be a very kind of day-to-day thing that we'd be able to use.
Behind it.
Of course, yeah. Of course. I mean, you know,
sometimes it feels like it's commercialized to the point of, I don't know how to put it, but like for AG1, for example, mm-hmm. it's so hard to know like whether or not the $100 a month or whatever it costs right. is a tangible like impact on your health that is worth
well, let
it.
Me let me tell you, because I use AG1.
Okay.
So, and of course it's an anecdote, but when I eat pasta mm-hmm. and pizza in Italy, I feel fine.
Yeah.
I can, you know, eat 5 pizzas a day and I feel fine. In US, when I eat 5 pizzas a day, I can't walk for a week. You know, your stomach gets bloated and you feel sick. You know, people break out, you know, all these different things that everybody complains. You know, same thing when I come to Armenia and, you know, I can eat, you know, the same volume of meat mm-hmm. Here. And I get fuller quicker here than I do in US. And this is because of, you know, nutritional values. These are pesticides, there's hormones, there's, you know, all these different things that we don't need to really get into. But it's very clear that the food in some of these other countries are much more higher organic quality. And higher quality than in US. And in US, you know, AG1 has definitely helped me in many different ways, from kind of no bloatedness in your stomach, and no random spikes of wanting random food throughout the day and wanting to snack and, you know, things like that. But again, it's one of those things that if you use it for, you know, all the time, then maybe your gut microbiome, kind of your bacteria in your stomach kind of get used to it. Then now this other thing happens and now you need. So you had to kind of take it, not take it, take it, not take it. You kind of have to figure out what's best for you as an individual and go from there.
That's so hard to do.
Hard to do. Everybody wants, you know, the magic pill, but you know, the best magic pill is for an individual to know exactly what's best for them by trial and error and figuring out what works, what doesn't work.
You know what my biotech dream is?
Mm.
I want like a consumer protection bureau.
Okay.
For all these supplements. And I don't want it to be like a government body. I want there to be like some company that takes all these products, evaluates it for, maybe for claims is asking for too much, mm-hmm. but just for like ingredient quality, like quantity of things that are in it that are as advertised and things like that. And if this is a company that becomes reputable and you can sort of trust it,
mm-hmm.
at least you know if you're buying this thing, it's... you're buying what it is, right? That at least would be make for like more informed
sure.
decision. Because otherwise,
sure.
like you listen to some podcast and the guy's like, yeah. man, I started taking AG1. yeah. I'm like, it's awesome. But like they're paying the guy 50 grand a month to say that.
Exactly.
Right? So like, I don't
exactly.
know what to do about that.
yeah, there's so many of those things too. It's like, yeah. you know, you... And there's all these jokes now. There's memes about all of that yeah. now too, right? It's like I wake up, you know, it's like what a tech bro does. You wake up in the morning, you look at the sun yeah. for 5 hours.
Yeah.
Then
like
you
Andrew Huberman
yeah,
just
yeah.
playing in the air is like
right. Then you take a you know yeah. a cold plunge,
exactly.
then sauna, then another you know
then
sun bath.
To go to sleep.
Right. Then you get naked, you run around. And you're like, okay, what the hell is going on? Yeah. I have to spend my whole yeah, day doing
exactly.
all these things for me to be healthy. But, you know, I think the best kind of diet in general, and this is, you know, my, I don't know if it's my philosophy or not, but I've kind of came to this understanding, is do whatever your ancestors have been doing for thousands of years for that region, right? So for example, I'm Armenian, I'm in the highlands of Armenia. A Mediterranean diet is what's best for me. You know, if you're from the islands, your Caribbean kind of diet is what's best for you. Your body is primed through hundreds of years to digest bananas better than I can. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that I shouldn't eat bananas. I love bananas, especially before a run. But I should listen to what, you know, my people have been eating in the mountains for hundreds and, you know, for millennia. And just listen to your body and that's it. But so to go back to...
Sorry, I mean,
look, I can talk about diet and exercise for hours, but since this is a tech podcast, let's focus on tech. So one of them is the gut microbiome and gut health related products that I think is going to be in our day to day. And then in the biotech SaaS kind of space, it's still a bit unpredictable. But one thing that I can very confidently say is that with eLab, we've created a marketplace where people can integrate their tools into the system. And then the scientists, while they're generating all their data and keeping track of it within eLab, they go into the marketplace kind of like a candy shop, and they look at which candy is the best for them in the app store. They look at which app is best for them, and then they're able to just utilize those kinds of apps to do, you know, small things within within their lab. And we're noticing a trend in computer vision related tools. We're noticing in multiomics analysis, proteomics analysis. We're noticing trend in like molecule detection kind of tools. There's actually a couple of them from Armenia. Like Toxometrics AI is one of them from computer vision. Modicus Prime from here, that's now in Texas. They recently got $3.5 million in funding. Congrats to them. Those are the kind of trends that we're definitely noticing that's quite fascinating. As far as kind of more advanced tools out there, it's still not very readily available. They're still in the early stages. They only have one or two clients. In some cases, they white label it and they give it to big pharma. You know, those kinds of things are happening as well. So it's interesting to see. And then as far as what me and Erwin kind of try to focus on when investing or consulting a company, specifically biotech SaaS company, I personally really pay attention to the people, not so much on the technology. You can, what's the word? You can sell, anyways, I forget what the-
Great
what the
tech saying. Without execution is not,
you know,
nothing
it's,
great.
And, you know, one thing that is very fascinating to see is you have someone that has a very strong engineering background, very strong analytical background, but when it comes for them to sell the product, it's just zero. They don't know how to do it. Or the complete opposite, you have a business person that wants to kind of do this and do that and only thinks about branding and marketing and so on, but they do not have the technical understanding to have that difficult conversations with the scientists that will end up using the product. So when we're looking at to which ones to invest in or which ones to even consult in the first place, because we're very selective, we don't want to just consult for nothing. We want to see successful companies. Is we really want to understand who these folks are, what their vision is, can they collaborate, and do they know what their fortes are and where their weaknesses are, so then we can fill in the gap when we come in as consultants.
Are there any companies in Armenia that you're working with or following?
Yeah. We're following few. We're working with few. I don't know if I can, you know, name any of the companies just yet. But yes, we're actively looking. There is great talent here. There's great ambition that's coming from here. Giving them that path towards the U.S. market is a very satisfying experience. But there isn't any kind of fully matured project right now that I can talk about. But we are actively looking. Same with, you know, in Netherlands as well. There's a few companies there that we're speaking with. So we'll see. We'll see how this develops.
Is it fair to say that even a small ecosystem like Armenia that doesn't necessarily have all the wet lab infrastructure and all the bio labs and things of that nature that are required to have a really thriving biotech ecosystem can still play a role in the global market because a lot of it is building the right software for some of these bigger players to use?
Absolutely, but to a certain point. Once you have the product, once you have the technology, once you have your kind of general branding and understanding as to what you want to do and how you want to do it, you have to be in the trenches where the market is. There's no ifs, ands, or maybes. There is no way around it. There was a period that people thought that, okay, especially during the pandemic, it's like, okay, all of the sales and everything can be done remotely through Zoom and so on. And sure, some of that can be done.
But
that died out. And in order for you to have trust, you have to be out there speaking the same language and understanding what people are going through, understanding the structure, the ecosystem that's in there, right? So for example, in Boston, in a, 10-minute walk of a radius, you're hitting, 500 different companies. And you need to understand who is who in that space. You need to know who the movers and shakers are. You need to know who the people are. You need to know their pain points. And the only way for you to know that is to be in there and talk with the people and be able to give them the solutions that they're looking for. Nobody in Germany sitting there can do that. And nobody in Armenia sitting, in their, cafe can figure that out. Regardless of how smart you are, how amazing your technology is, just simply not possible. So, I think the best kind of combination is, because there is a very strong math and engineering background here, you have the back office here, you have the administrative office here, you develop everything here, but you have the commercial side of things out there.
Sales, go to market.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you set up in Boston, you set up in, San Francisco, then you maybe go to Canada and you kind of grow from there organically, but you have to be out there in the field.
It seems like to a large extent, that's probably true for even the more traditional tech spaces. Like we see most Armenian AI companies, most Armenian just general SaaS companies start here, build out engineering here, 90% of their workforce is here, mm-hmm. but sales and marketing sometimes usually and things of that nature are in somewhere in California, maybe sometimes in Europe and things of that nature. And it makes sense, like you said, right? Like the market is not Armenia, and that's not a bad thing. Like you want to build global first from day
exactly.
one.
Exactly. Germany does that. Netherlands does
Israel
that.
Does that. Israel does that. Estonia does
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Like, everybody's doing that. I think there is, in Armenia, we have this feeling like we have to stay here and we have to build the infrastructure here and the ecosystem here. We feel this obligation because of our, our history and our passion for our culture and for our people, which I think is very beautiful.
But it's a hindrance to
it is, from a business perspective. I mean, even our company, Elab Next, it's a Dutch company in Netherlands, but it's very clear that in order for it to grow, you have to be where the market growth is, which is, Boston and all these other places in Benelux area in Germany and so on. And you create these satellite offices and these satellite kind of places for you to grow. And, that's happening across the board. And in our space as well, in the biotech space, we notice, Israeli companies, we notice German companies that their headquarters are in, where they come from, but then the commercial side. And then the difficulties at that point is making sure that there is alignment between those offices. And because sometimes the commercial gets overambitious and the HQ is not able to support, or vice versa. The commercial is not understanding what the vision is from the HQ, mm-hmm. and then those problems start to arise. And that's very common in the industry. So the key is, once you have established their HQ, and then you have those the folks that are out there, mm-hmm. To make sure that there's constant alignment and understanding as to what the vision and the mission is of the company.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. Like the one conversation that sometimes drives me a little crazy is like, people want to obsess over corporate registration. Mm-hmm. Like, why isn't the company only registered in Armenia? And I think even British companies are Delaware C Corps, right? And you're not going to get as developed as the UK in overnight. So and even if you did, your startups would still be Delaware C Corps. So, and it's still registered in Armenia as well, but anyways, tangential. Before we wrap up, something I was curious to ask you. So you've become an exec at a leading biotech company that operates in the US and Europe and around the world. Now you're doing this consulting and investment work, but you've also started a business, I think you have maybe a couple of businesses, mm-hmm. Not in the tech space.
Right.
You have a Thai company.
Yep.
Why not start a biotech company? Why a Thai company? And by the way, and they're beautiful ties. Tell people where they can take a look at them.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
these beautiful Armenian rug designs.
Right.
Ties.
So yeah, no, tell people about I appreciate that. Yeah. So, it's a passion project for me. That's how it started. you know, I've taken art classes, you know, all my life. I've been drawing and painting, and I've always been fascinated by different symbolism that's, you know, on our monasteries, on our rugs and carpets, on, you know, in caves that we find these days, right? Or these dragon rocks that we call them, that are spread out all over Armenia, and the Stonehenges. And, you know, then you take a step back and you look at, you know, what the Aztecs did, you know, you look at what the Romans did, you look, you know, all these beautiful cultures have created these amazing kind of designs. And, you know, I've looked at those as a child and always wondered, like, okay, what is the meaning behind them? What does this mean? Why did our ancestors decide to draw this particular design and use these geometric shapes and, you know, things like that? And we can go into crazy theories as to, you know, what that is. For some reason, a lot of people now give that to, you know, DMT use and then, you know, drugs psilocybin and all these different things. I don't know if that's the case. I personally do not think those things are healthy for you. I don't participate in that, unlike many other Silicon Valley tech bros. But, you know, I've been fascinated by it. I started researching it, and it took me 3 years to come to this realization that I want a tie that I, because I wear ties for work all the time, and I wanted one for me to feel good about my background and my culture and just be connected to many other cultures by wearing something like that. So I designed one, wore it, went to a stem cell research conference, and every single person commented on it. Everyone, oh, wow, cool, what is that? And
this is a one-off you made for yourself?
Yes, yeah, I made like 12 in the beginning, gave it to like family members, friends, you know, things like that. And then all of a sudden I realized that something special. So then I just decided to make a, and you know, the idea was, it's a passion project. I also wanted to be, you know, eco-friendly. I wanted to create jobs in Armenia. So we started working with these 8 retired women that were, you know, handcrafting all of this. And, you know, it felt good to do something like that. So I did that as a passion project. It, you know, it took a lot of effort, but at the same time, it was effortless because it was a passion project. It didn't feel like I have to make money, I have to do this. I didn't have that pressure. It was just something that I did on the side through the help of the co-founder, Yerazik, who was here in Armenia. As a matter of fact, I'm currently looking for someone to purchase that company off of me because I'm not being able to keep up.
Remind people what it's called.
It's called Erebuni Clothing. Mm-hmm. Erebuni Clothing on you know, the website erebuniclothing.com on
Instagram.
It's
socks and ties, right?
No, it's only just ties. Okay. It's only ties. We have designed, you know, handkerchiefs or, you know, you put in your blazer. We've designed all these other things as prototypes, but we've never kind of went forward with it. So I am looking for some kind of a, you know, person that comes from that world, from the fashion world, because that's not mine. I'm not, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, the importance of being out there in the trenches, right?
Yeah.
You know, I am in biotech. That's my space. I am in tech. That's my space. Clothing line, you know, I'm not in Rome at these, you know, fashion shows. I'm not in these kinds of places. So it's not sustainable. You know, the passion could take me to a certain point, but from that point on, you know, you need someone that specializes in this stuff and is from this place for them to be able to take it to the next level. So to your question, this is a really long answer to your question as to why not start a, you know, biotech company. That requires a lot more effort, requires a lot more work. And, you know, there's things that are, you know, conversations that are brewing here and there, you know, with different folks, but nothing has come to that, didn't culminate to a point where we're like, you know what, let's do it. And the satisfaction of kind of starting something from ground zero and seeing it succeed now with this, you know, consulting / investing firm, I do get that satisfaction because now we, you know, we take part in these developing these companies from zero to something. And that part of my brain gets satisfied of starting something, even though that's not particularly mine. I might have, you know, few percentages within it or, you know, whatever the case is. But hey, God willing, maybe there is something that comes along my way. I'd be more than ready to kind of roll up my sleeves and start something.
When the day comes, I hope you'll come back on and share with us first.
Absolutely.
Zyogen, thank you so much. It's always a blast talking to you. Next time you come on, let's do a more even let's dive into all the like non-tech topics.
Let's do it.
We'll have an awesome time talking about. Let's do it.
Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun. Thank you so much. As always.
Thank you, brother.
Cheers. Thanks.